anymore. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab.
Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth for the beginning of the second hour. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight.
Going to be talking giving you a brief introduction to our 2 hours tonight. Both hours are rebroadcast, but both are very worthwhile broadcast, I feel. The first hour is Dr. John Lott, okay? And he's author of a book entitled More Guns and Less Crime. And in that book, he says that violent crime rates go down when states pass shall issue concealed carry laws. And he presents the results of statistical analysis of crime data for every county in the United States during 29 years from 1977 to 2005. And he's had several editions been published by the University of Chicago Press. And he goes into detail, and he really has some fine examples of what's going on and why really that more guns does equate out to less crime. He talks about shall issue laws, and he says that shall issue laws on violent crime across the United States. His conclusion is that shall issue laws which allow citizens to carry concealed weapons steadily decrease violent crime. He explains that this result makes sense because criminals are deterred by the risk of attacking an armed victim. As more citizens arm themselves, the danger to criminals increases, and so that's why the crime rate in these areas has decreased. We had a recent event Thursday in Dallas on the 7th of July, and it was called, there was a demonstration up there by activists. Black Lives Matter was one of the key organizing groups, and there were others. And at that, there were five Dallas policemen that were killed. There was a crossfire, evidently, from not only on the street level, but up above from parking garages. And five Dallas policemen, one transit policeman, and four Dallas policemen died as a result of those attacks by, we think, elements possibly on Black Lives Matter. We don't know for sure. There are three people under arrest. A third person holed himself up in a parking garage. They sent one of those robots in there and blew a bomb up and killed him with a bomb. The first reports was that last night was that he was held up and he killed himself or he committed suicide. But later on, that would prove not to be accurate. I think they sent the robot in there with a bomb and then blew up the bomb, and that killed the shooter in the parking garage. We have a period here that is becoming very, very dangerous for Americans. And I put this gun program on here and rebroadcast it because we've got to get guns into law-abiding citizens' hands so they can be protected from a rising possible terrorist or shooters like this that occurred in Dallas and in schools or whatever. And I just can't understand the left, the Democratic left in particular, that is out there with Hillary leading the charge on gun control. Just don't understand that at all. And I believe that it's good to own and possess guns. I think the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, some people give an argument, put an argument forward that, no, that's a well-regulated militia. Well, every grown man in the United States is part of the so-called militia. So every adult person, male that is, or even women, of course, now that would be classified as part of the militia, have a right to keep and bear arms. Now, the way that I explained it to a person the other day that put up this argument, I said, okay, let's say that a man that's a member of a well-regulated militia, like the Constitution specifies in some of its jargon there, some of its wordage there. Let's say that man is on the way to a meeting of the well-regulated militia, but he has he's armed, and he gets jumped by some muggers or some criminals or whatever, and he protects himself. Well, then that's really the finest example that I can give of the right to keep and bear arms, because it's not only a natural law. The thing is that when we're born into the world, we have built into our genes, we have an innate nature to self-protect ourselves. And, you know, government didn't give us that, but natural law was the basis of that. And the natural law gave rise to the natural right to protect oneself. And that is what the Founding Fathers were building into the Constitution, was bringing. They were well-versed in natural law. And so when they were taught and coming up in their formative years and being educated and stuff, they read about the natural law and became convinced and started using some of those concepts and ideas to put not only into the Declaration of Independence, but into the Constitution and subsequent the Bill of Rights and so forth, which the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, is there. So we've got to try to make sense of this ongoing, perhaps a gladio operation that's occurring in the country. Todd Fletcher, who was one of the producers of Guns and Butter on the West Coast there, he and I interviewed him several times, and he and I were both of the opinion that a possible gladio, you could say, operation had been started in this country. Over in Europe, the gladio operation was to create tension. It was actually terrorism that was formulated and put forward by intelligence services within the European countries, the NATO members, to tension the societies away from communism and into social democracy, democratic political parties, you could say. So this has been well written and documented by Dr. Gassner out of Switzerland. There's a Gladio, the Secret Army. So I would highly recommend that you get that book and read it. We may be subject to this kind of an ongoing operation. Not that this shooting in Dallas was specifically that kind of operation, but there are agent provocateurs that chum up to some of those groups and can provoke them into taking actions like we're taking on Thursday in Dallas with the shooting deaths of those officers and the wounding of another six to eight. So there were just, it's just tragic when I was coming up as a young boy here in Austin, Texas, it was so much different. There was so much difference of this culture and society than today. We're entering in a very chaotic period for America, and in this very, very chaotic period, it's getting very, very dangerous, not only for citizens out there on the street that are unarmed, not protected, but also it's like someone just recently said, the right to keep and bear arms is to protect oneself from a very oppressive government. Okay, that's really what we're talking about here. And so That's why I firmly believe and very strongly back up the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, and I just won't ever get off of that. And John Locke brings evidence that the more people that are armed with concealed carry in the cities, they have a lower rate of crime. The cities, characteristically in this country, that have the most stringent gun control laws have the highest gun violence. And Chicago is a very prime example of that very fact right there. And I think we talked to it when I interviewed him. This interview goes back several years, but it's well worth listening to again because it's not dated, and it's related very directly to what happened in Dallas. We've got to start providing protection for our citizens from these kinds of ongoing events of violence and so forth, whether it's black violence or if it's terrorist violence. So we've got to really get on top of this. The second thing that occurred this week, which has created a hullabaloo, is that the director of the FBI, James Comey, finally voiced an opinion, held a big press conference, voiced an opinion earlier in the week, and actually let Hillary off. His presentation was interesting because he laid out all these problems that she had with the misuse and the unauthorized use of classified material. He laid out all these facts at the beginning of his presentation, but at the end he said that no reasonable prosecutor would bring charges. So, I mean, there was a disconnect here. So later on, the Congress got into it and said, okay, they called him in to quiz him on this, and he did reply and got back with them. And yesterday, on Thursday, July 7th, he laid out for 5 hours they had questioning of him by this committee of Congress. And I watched all 5 hours, and it was very educational in the sense that even in greater detail, he did give some comparisons to General Petraeus and this case that they had against Hillary. And he gave some examples of why they went ahead and prosecuted Petraeus, but that he was recommending to the Justice Department that they not prosecute Hillary. Well, as he was speaking, and he was quizzed by more and more of these U.S. representatives that sat on the committee, more and more details came out, and more reasons came out in the questioning of Director Comey that she should have been indicted, and she was guilty of multiple charges. Some of the more interesting things that came out when I was watching it was that he was talking about Petraeus hiding classified material in his home. And at first he said that classified material was hidden up in the attic underneath some insulation. Later that afternoon, he reiterated that, but he changed it. He said later that he was sorry that he had said that he was mistaken, he said. He said, actually, they found the classified information in his desk. Now, which one was it? I don't know. I mean, was the first statement accurate? And was the second one the more accurate and truthful? I don't know. But that's very interesting. Also, he said in the Petraeus investigation the FBI conducted, there was obstruction of justice seemed to be one of the stronger charges that they came up with. Yes, Petraeus did misuse classified information by providing it to his girlfriend and so forth. But Director Comey seemed to indicate with his answers that, yes, obstruction of justice was a charge that they referred over to the Justice Department as the FBI having uncovered evidence. because I believe General Petraeus did lie to the FBI. And so one of those, that's one of the big things. And then he was secreting classified material in his home, which he shouldn't, that was unauthorized to have at home and so forth. Now, this question about hiding it up underneath the insulation, well, I don't know where that came from. Why would Director Comey say that and then, you know, change his, you know, and apologize about having said that and been wrong? I guess he was mistaken, right? So, anyway, but when they referred this case and all their evidence and their the conclusion of their investigation, the Justice Department took a felony charge, reduced it to misdemeanor, and then ignored totally any obstruction of justice and never brought any charges against Petraeus, and he negotiated for a final sentencing and so forth. Well, we just saw recently at the Bilderberg meeting, General Petraeus was a member there in good standing and shows up. I know he was over in Copenhagen because I was over there, you know, and I know he was there at Dresden. So we have people that have been convicted of mishandling classified information sitting in there with the Bilderberg group. So we know that they're just, you know, they're an open book for the, and the wealthiest people in the world are members of this Bilderberg group that meets annually. So we've got a country been corrupted, the big money, the military-industrial complex, or I say the military-industrial financial complex, or you could say the financial-military-industrial complex, has just really just destroyed everything and corrupted everything with the big money. And so as a result, we're not getting justice and so forth, and we're just getting, you know, oh, it's just terrible. Anyway, getting back to Hillary, okay? One of the other interesting aspects of this in the quizzing of Comey, Director Comey, was that he said that Hillary provided emails to her attorney that contained classified information. Now, the people that worked for the attorney, they looked at those and read those emails. And some of those emails contain classified information, but those people that read those that were working for the attorney's office did not have security classifications, security clearances. So actually, Hillary provided classified material to her attorney, who in turn turned it over to people that were not authorized to even view it. That right there is just another problem, you know, that wells up, you know. So anyway, it sort of went like that. I mean, the more the director spoke, the bigger the indictment of, and the more convinced the watchers, me and others, were convinced that she was guilty on multiple levels of multiple charges and so forth, and a very highly classified material. I was in the Army Security Agency for 3 years, and we had procedures for handling classified information. And at the end of every day, we collected up bits and pieces of paper here and there and put them in these what we call burn bags. And we had a security detail that were armed. They went over to the incinerator and burned all this paperwork, see, that was left over, that was collected up. We didn't leave anything in any of our sites or any of our, you know, interception, you could say, sites or anything else that could be used by for spies or anything else. But so we burned, you know, we burned material daily that could have possibly been used by spies or our adversaries. Comey also, Director Comey said he deferred to answer on the grounds that some actors out there or some, you know, entities that were adversaries to the United States did hack her server and declined to answer that, and said that he could provide that information to the chairman, but outside of this public forum. So evidently, they did get evidence that a major power had hacked her, had gotten information from that unprotected server. See, so it just went on and on. If you want to see the full 5 hours, you can go into C-SPAN and they you can play it there and watch it. But I would recommend that you go in and watch that and very carefully make an assessment there of what you know what you think was what was the final bottom line on Hillary. But at the more he was examined by these different representatives, the worse it got. That's the way I see it, to where it was absolutely positive, you know, and anyone viewing that, I don't care if they're Democrat or Republican, that Hillary was guilty of those charges of the misuse and mishandling of classified information. And so I just, you know, she got the politics. She's part of the Bilderberg group. Petraeus is over there. He got excused and tapped on the wrist on his violations. Sandy Berger was another man that worked for the Clintons earlier on. He stole classified archives out of the National Archives and was also convicted of that. So that's what we've got. We've got a very corrupt system. Hey, check this out and listen closely to what's coming up. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Let me tell you about our final guest for this evening. The name is John Lott. He's the author of More Guns, Less Crime. He has a doctorate in economics from UCLA in 1984. He's virtually written over 90 articles in academic journals. His interests are economics, law, crime, public choice, education, writing. He goes on and on. He's very sharp. He was on Coast to Coast last night. I listened to one of the finest interviews I think George Norrie's ever conducted. And I want to welcome to our program John Lott. We're very, very honored to have you, John Lott. And we certainly do appreciate your work. And let's start out. How did you get involved in writing this book, More Guns and Less Crime? What was your motivational factors in getting that going several years ago?
Right. Well, I was teaching at the Wharton School of Business, and I was teaching a class on crime. And before that, I'd been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and I'd taught a lot of classes on crime and written economics papers on crime and law enforcement. And some students asked me if I could give a brief discussion on gun control, and I figured, well, you know, why not? But to do that, it kind of forced me to go through the literature. I hadn't really been very interested in the literature on guns up to that point. And I'd seen some of it, but I hadn't systematically gone through it. I guess I'd always assumed that there were better papers someplace else. And I was just pretty shocked by how poorly done the existing research was. Large studies would look at 31 counties from the United States. I could never figure out how you pick out 31 counties out of 3,140 counties to look at. And when you're an academic, one of the reasons why you do research is you think you can do a better job than other people have, or you have a new idea, and it's usually the latter. But I thought, you know, it'd be worthwhile to do the study the right way, and it took me a couple of years to put it together and started off as an academic paper and got some attention, and then University of Chicago Press asked me to turn it into a book.
Right. Did your ideas change?
That came out in 1998. The third edition just came out in 2010.
Oh, right. Well, then it has sticking power, doesn't it? Staying power, does it? Does it not?
Yeah, no, I'd say so. The third edition has about 300 more pages of material than the first edition had.
What would you say has been this additional research that you've added to the third edition? But also, then you've made it very, very current, have you not?
Well, there are a lot of things that have changed over the last decade. The third edition came out in 2010. The second edition came out in 2000. Over the last decade, we had the sunsetting of the assault weapons ban. You've had a lot of states have stand-your-ground type laws. My research was the first one to look at that. You've had more states adopt right to carry. We now have 41 states that are right to carry. Really a major change in the last few decades. You go back to 1986, You had 21 states that completely banned concealed carry. You had another 20 states, which made it difficult. You basically had to go and get the approval of some public official, like a judge or a sheriff, before they would let you carry a concealed handgun. With the appeals court decision last week and for Illinois, Illinois had been the last state that had banned people being able to carry concealed handguns completely. And the judges said that that was unconstitutional. And so now there'll be 42 states that are right to carry and only eight, which require that you have to go and get some type of public official's approval. But all the states have some process for people to be able to carry concealed handguns. So that's a pretty major change since 1986.
Well, I'll say that your book probably had a lot to do with that. Are there legislators that are talking to you and interviewing you all the time about your different proposals and assertions in this book?
Well, I've talked to a number of people. I've testified before state legislators many times. You know, who knows how much impact research has versus other experiences. I mean, surely the fact that permit holders have tended to be extremely law-abiding matters. The most recent data that I've seen for Florida, for example, which is fairly typical, but it has unusually good data on its website, between October 1st, 1987 and the end of June this year, Florida had issued permits to over 2.3 million people, the average person that had their permits for about 13 years. And yet with millions of people having permits and all those years that they had them for, only 168 had their permits revoked for any type of firearms-related violation. The vast majority of those were for two simple reasons. Either one, they accidentally carried their permanent concealed handgun into a gun-free zone, like an airport, for example, or a school, or they forgot to have their permit with them when they were carrying. Both of those are considered firearms-related violations, and they lose their permits for that. So even, but 168 out of 2.3 million is only, is 7/1000ths of one percentage point. It's 0.007%. It's pretty tiny. And, you know, it's the type of thing you find when you look at other states. Permit holders are extremely law-abiding. They rarely get into any type of trouble. And my guess is it's been very important in having all these different states adopt these rules.
Well, I tell you what, is brandishing a gun a crime in most states?
Well, it depends why you're brandishing it. If you're brandishing it because you're being threatened, then, you know, it's not a problem. You're brandishing it to threaten somebody, then it's a real problem. Then it's a crime.
Well,
it's a crime
there's so many statistics like that, that where things are avoided, crimes are avoided by someone brandishing a gun and keeping someone from imposing a crime on them or attacking them. I mean, there's so many different hidden, statistics like that, are there not?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the way most crimes are stopped, is not firing the gun. People who use guns defensively very rarely fire the gun. Simply having the gun, simply letting the criminal know that you have a gun, is enough to get criminals to run away and break off the attack. They know the cost of getting involved against somebody who might be able to defend themselves. And, I think you're exactly right. Those are important statistics. And you know, the news media doesn't cover those types of cases, even though you may have 95% or so of the time simply brandishing guns sufficient to cause a criminal break off an attack. You know, that's not really newsworthy. Defensive gun uses that get covered are going to be cases when the criminal's been killed.
Right. We're going to take a break real quick here. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Thank you for being with us this evening, John Lund. Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is out tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lund. Yeah, welcome back to our program, John Lund.
Thank you.
Okay, on this gun-free zones, can that be rather problematic? And what is the trend in those areas, in universities and, say, public school systems? What kind of information and have you developed in that area?
Right. Well, I'm sure everybody kind of understands the motivations behind having these gun-free zones. The idea is if you simply ban guns from an area, you'll make them safer. The problem is, this is true for gun control laws generally, is who obeys the laws. And if it turns out there's the law-abiding good citizens who don't have guns there, but the criminals do, then you can unintentionally make things a lot worse. Now, I suppose the simplest way to think about this is that if somebody was seriously threatening you or your family, was stalking you, would you feel safer putting a sign in front of your home that said this home is a gun-free zone? My guess is nobody would do that. And the reason is pretty obvious. You don't want to go and tell a criminal who's stalking you, you know, if he's really stalking you, that there's no weapon inside the home in order to try to protect yourself. What that does is that actually serves as an invitation for him to come and go and get you. And you know, we see this all the time. All these multiple victim public shootings are occurring where guns are banned. You know, you look at something like the Aurora movie theater shooting this summer. There are 7 movie theaters within a 20-minute drive of the killer's apartment that were showing the new Batman movie that was being released. The killer didn't go to the movie theater that was closest to his home. He didn't go to the largest one. He went to the only movie theater that banned permit holders from being able to carry their handguns into the movie theater. And you see that, you know, the Sikh temple, the Portland Mall shooting that just occurred earlier this week, the shooting on Friday. In fact, if you look at all the multiple victim public shootings since at least 1950, with only one exception, all those multiple victim public shootings where more than 3 people have been killed have all taken place where guns are banned. You know, you name a shooting, and it's going to take place where guns are banned. And so, you know, I understand the motivation to try to make things safe, but what's happened is that rather than making those safe areas, they serve as magnets for the criminals to go. That's where they want to do their attack. They want to do their attack where they know that their victims aren't going to be able to defend themselves. And you know, you look at things, even the Columbine shooting back in 98, you had a situation where the Dylan Klebold in particular, but both of the killers there, were strongly opposed to the concealed carry law. It's my understanding that Lisa Klebold was writing to state legislators asking that they not vote in favor of the law. And what few people seem to realize is that the final vote for the state legislature to pass the concealed handgun law there was scheduled the very day that the Columbine attack occurred. And what apparently had upset Klebold the most was that that concealed carry law would have allowed people to carry permanent concealed handguns on university, on high school property, on school property. So, you know, you just see this time after time. There are only usually very small areas in states which are banned, which are posted for you not being able to carry concealed handguns. And yet those are the places where all these attacks are occurring. You know, if it was random, then only a very small percentage of the attacks would be taking place in these gun-free zones. But that's not the case.
You know, you said something earlier in one of your writings there that you've suffered over the years in taking this ban and writing this book, have you not?
Oh, I don't know if I want to get into that too much. I mean, there are a few things, but, you know, things like Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago, when I was at the University of Chicago, he basically threatened the University of Chicago with losing, you know, operations that they were doing with the city of Chicago if they didn't get rid of me and things like that.
Right, so, Well, I didn't want to delve into it too deeply, but, I mean, it seems like that this liberal mindset out here can't let go of the fact that they demonize the gun itself. right, and ignore the individual that has to pull the trigger, right?
Right. Well, I'm not sure I would argue that way from your perspective. The way I would say it is, look, guns do make it easier for bad things to happen. I don't think one should argue against that. But I think the point to make is that guns also make it easier to defend yourself and prevent bad things from happening. And the question is, what's the net effect that's there? Look, my research finds that the police are the single most important factor for reducing crime. I'm convinced about that. But one thing the police will tell you when you talk to them is that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And, you know, they'll tell you themselves that they strongly support letting citizens be able to go and defend themselves when the police aren't able to be there in order to protect them. You look at surveys by the National Association of Chiefs of Police. You have about 78% of those police chiefs around the country support people being able to carry concealed handguns. In fact, they support a national concealed carry, just like a driver's license. If you get a concealed license in Oklahoma or someplace else, just like you get a driver's license there, you should be able to go and drive your car any place and should be able to take your permit concealed handgun when you travel, too. And if you look at street officers are even more supportive. Depending upon the poll, you're often talking about something about 85% to 90% of street officers support citizens being able to carry permanent concealed handguns for protection. They see firsthand the benefits in their own life from having a gun for protection, and they understand why they are important, that they just can't be there all the time to protect people. And so, you know, they understand firsthand the benefits from people being able to carry concealed handguns.
Right. Have there been instances where, at schools and so forth over the years, where individuals had guns in their cars or trucks and went out and stopped even a further carnage? Have there been cases like that?
Oh, there have been many cases like that. You have public schools like Pearl, Mississippi or Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. You have universities like the Appalachian Law School in Virginia, in which an attack was stopped. You have churches like the New Life Church in Colorado a few years ago, where you had one of these mega churches. It was 7,000 people. One of the parishioners there was a former Chicago police officer, but she had stopped doing that years earlier. Her former husband was stalking her, so she had gotten a concealed handgun permit. And she had asked the minister whether it was all right for her to carry a concealed handgun there at church because she was worried that if she didn't have it with her while she was at church, then she would be vulnerable either on her way to church or on her way from church. And the minister said, sure, no problem. And what happened was a killer there killed a couple people in the parking lot, went into the church, and at that point, this permit holder wounded him, and he committed suicide. But he had like 1,000 rounds of ammunition, and there were 7,000 people in the church.
Right. We've got to take another break, and we'll be right back. Thank you, John Lott. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
I'm George Butler, Charlotte Little Phillies off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lott.
Well, thank you.
Well, I tell you what, John, you really, you know, done your research on this, and you really have a lot of details and facts at your fingertips. What is the concept and ideas right now on common law right to carry as far as in your vehicle or on your person? Is there any common law rights throughout the country in the 50 states?
Well, it's pretty much determined by statute. And it varies a lot from state to state. There's some states that you don't need to have a permit to carry in your car. There are other states that do require that you have a permit, so it's just, you know, it varies a lot, and just incumbent upon you to kind of know what the rules are.
Right. As far as your studies go from when you first started writing your book, was it 1998? Is that when it was first published, the first edition?
That's correct.
Okay, now you're in your third edition. In the real inner cities, have you seen a major change there in crime because of the right to carry or whatever? Do you have statistics that would indicate anything like that?
Right. Well, in fact, there are two groups of people who benefit the most from being able to carry. One group are people who are relatively weak physically, women, the elderly. But the second group of people refers to the area that you're talking about, and that is people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. And that's a very well-defined group, unfortunately, in our society. It's poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. I mean, again, it'd be great if the police were there to protect people all the time, and the police are extremely important, but they arrive on the crime scenes after the crime's been committed, usually, and that means that people who are the victims of crime, most likely to be victims of crime, benefit the most from having guns for protection.
Right. Now, how does this drug culture factor into this? Has this been a really synergistically negative on getting the crime just embroiled and increased in these different areas?
Yeah, well, if you look across the United States, about 80% of the counties in any given year have zero murders. You have over 70% of the murders in the United States occur in about 3% of the counties. And if you ever live in a major city, you know, whether it be New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or Washington, D.C., often the major newspapers in those areas will go and once a year or so have a map of how murders are distributed in those cities. And they're not all over the place. Even in those places, they're very heavily concentrated in very small areas within those cities. So not only do you have over 70% of murders in just 3% of the counties, but even within that 3%, they're in very tiny areas within that 3%. And a lot of that is drug gang, either directly or indirectly related. And, and that creates lots of problems.
What you're saying is on the periphery of some of these drug areas, it makes sense to have a gun handy because you might get caught up inadvertently from some of this drug war going on. I mean, is that good thinking there?
Right. Well, I mean, it's not just the people who are directly in the drug gangs, the fights there, but you have people who are kind of secondary involved who are not exactly the best people to hang around with, and they threaten other people. But that's exactly right. Those are the areas where people benefit the most from having the option to be able to protect themselves. You have a lot of people whose lives are messed up in different ways from the drugs. They're probably not the best people to be around. And you have crime for many different reasons in those areas, and those are the people who benefit from protection. One of the things to point out, though, is just as it's very hard to stop illegal drugs from coming into the country, I mean, these drug gangs, it's very hard to stop them getting their drugs. It's also very hard to stop them from getting the weapons that they use to protect their drugs. I mean, here they have something extremely valuable. It's not like if one gang comes over and steals another gang's drugs, the second gang goes to the police and say, could you help us get our drugs back? They have to go and have their weapons there in order to stop the drugs from being stolen to begin with or to take them back. They set up their own little armies. And just as they can smuggle in the drugs, they can smuggle in the weapons that they use to protect those drugs. And so you see countries like that have had gun bans, like Ireland or Jamaica or the UK, they still have plenty of guns in those countries. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that whenever you see gun bans go into place, even in island nations, which you would think would be kind of the ideal experiment for a gun ban, you see increases in murder rates after the ban's been put in place. I can't find a place around the world where we've had gun bans that you don't see an increase in murder and violent crime after the ban's in place there. And the reason is simple. It basically follows along what we were saying at the beginning of the program, and that is the people who obey these laws are the good, law-abiding citizens, not the criminals. And to the extent that you disarm the law-abiding citizens relative to the criminals, you make it easier for those criminals to engage in their crime.
Well, I tell you what, I just wish more Americans would start catching on to this, because there's a population out there that thinks diametrically opposed to this, is there not?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the media has a big impact on this. People constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns. They rarely, if ever, hear about any of the benefits from guns. And it has a big impact on people's perceptions. I mean, when was the last time you watched ABC, NBC, CBS, or CNN, or MSNBC and heard a story about somebody using guns to protect themselves, protect somebody else? And I guess you've never heard a story on those networks about that. And if you constantly hear about bad things that happen and never hear about any benefits, it has a real impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns. You know, the government does a survey every year to try to figure out how many crimes are committed with guns, because they know not all crimes are reported. And you'll have something like about, 150,000 gun crimes are reported to police each year, maybe 175,000. And there's about 400,000, some years maybe, well, it's about 400,000 right now, gun crimes that are indicated in terms of the surveys. Well, if you do a similar survey in terms of defensive gun use, you find that people use guns defensively to stop crime about 2 million times a year. That means people use guns defensively to stop crime about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year than guns are used in the commission of crime. But few would know that, because they get most of their information from the media and they only hear about the bad things and never about the benefits. But I think the media has a big impact in another way, and that is, we have these attacks, whether it be at the Aurora movie theaters or the mall shooting or the school shootings this week. How many people know that those attacks, all as well as all the other ones that they could think of, are occurring where guns are banned? And you know, they just refuse. That's probably the simplest fact that they could go and check, but they never bring it up. Instead, you have them go through things that they're often wrong about. So you have half the people or more believe that the guy who did the Aurora movie theater shooting was wearing body armor. You know, I don't know how many times you hear about the claim that he had a bulletproof vest. Well, he didn't have. First of all, there's no such thing as a bulletproof vest. It's bullet-resistant vest. But even in that case, he didn't have a bulletproof vest. He had something called an assault vest. And what an assault vest is, essentially made out of nylon, which is hardly bullet-resistant. And it has extra pockets so somebody can hold extra magazines to reload his gun. And, and yet somehow the media has kind of spun that into a bulletproof vest.
Right, okay. John, we've got to take another break. We'll come back to our final segment. Get this off together to give the best advice to the public that you can. We certainly appreciate your being with us this evening. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, John Lott.
Thank you.
Yeah, this last segment, I'm going to give you the floor, and you can tell us what I missed in asking you, or what other very important points that you feel like that we should bring out during this last segment. So you got the floor.
Well, if you want to talk about these mass public shootings, one of the things that's clear when you read the diaries or other documents that these people leave behind or listen to the videotapes is that they're intent on committing suicide. And indeed, 75% of the people who engage in these types of attacks die at the scene. And the other 25%, it's pretty clear that they intended on committing suicide, but just couldn't bring themselves to actually kill themselves at the end there. And but what they want to do is they want to kill themselves in a way that's going to go and get attention for them. And It's really chilling to go and read what they've written, because they're often very explicit that they realize that they can go and get more. The more people they kill, the more publicity that they can get. And so, you know, the issue basically is how do you take away that gain that they view in their warped mind that they get from doing these crimes? And there are a couple things to point out. One is they thrive on the attention. They are doing this. They're trying to kill as many people because they believe that's the way they can get more attention. So to the extent to which, and I'm not saying this is something that's going to change, but to the extent to which the media, you know, gives attention to these guys, they are encouraged to do this. If the media tomorrow stopped publishing their names, that would probably reduce to a good extent the rate at which these attacks occur. The second thing is that one of the reasons why they pick these gun-free zones to engage in these crimes is because they know a pretty simple truth, and that is things that I've found in my research, and that is the longer the amount of time it takes for somebody with a gun to arrive on the scene to stop them, the more carnage that you're going to have. And the faster you can get a gun there, the sooner you can stop it. And police, you know, 8-minute response time is phenomenal. 5 minutes is unheard of. And yet in 5 minutes or 8 minutes or 10, you can have a world of hurt that's going to be caused in that situation. And so one thing that's proven to be very successful in the cases that we've talked about is to let people have the option to be able to go and defend themselves. You constantly hear fears about, well, will bystanders be shot or what have you, and yet out of all the cases that we talked about where permit holders have stopped these attacks, there's not a single instance where a permit holder has accidentally shot a bystander. You know, people often compare us to Europe. When we have these types of shootings, I often get calls from the media in other countries. But one thing is very clear, and that is Europe actually has about the same rate of multiple victim public shootings that we have here in the United States. It doesn't get the same attention when they occur. And also, I think because you have so many different countries, people don't kind of add them up. But you have to put it on a per capita rate. You just can't compare Norway or Germany to the United States. And when you add them up across all the countries and put it on a per capita rate, they're very similar rates between the United States and Europe. I mean, not only did you have the Norway attack last year in which 69 people were shot to death, another 110 were wounded as a result of the shooting, you know, ignoring the deaths from the bombing that he had. Two years ago, you had 12 people killed in Britain by a taxi cab driver. You had attacks in Finland at both a mall and a university 2 years ago. You've had France has had numerous attacks over the last few years. Germany, if you look at Germany, Germany has had 2 of the 4 worst public school shootings. And you know, my guess is most Americans wouldn't have a clue about that, yet Germany has extremely restrictive gun control laws. You know, it takes more than a year to go and get a long gun permit. You have to undergo 2 psychological screening tests. But, you know, the problem is that when somebody plans one of these attacks for many months in advance, it's very hard to stop them. And for somebody who wants to die in these attacks, if you combine somebody who wants to die, who's willing to die, and is willing to put the time into making these attacks go, you know, it's very difficult to stop people in those situations. You know, one of the comparisons that you often see made is people will say, well, look at murder rates in the United States and compare them to Britain or to Germany, and our murder rate is significantly higher. And they say, well, we have more guns, and so guns cause the higher murder rate. There's a really pretty obvious problem there, and that is murder rates and crime rates vary across countries for lots of reasons. The most powerful comparison, I think, is to see what happens to an individual country after its gun control laws change. So, for example, before London had any gun control, you had a city of about 8 million people. There were 2 gun murders in 1900. And murder rates have gone up after each of the major gun control regulations that have been put in place in Britain. Same with Germany, same with other countries. When you see bans, you see these increases in murder rates. So if you accept the fact that there are many different reasons that murder rates differ across countries, for any individual country, just like it was true for Chicago and Washington, D.C., where we had bans there and saw huge increases in murder rates, you see the same thing across these other countries. So I don't know what else you want me to say, but I mean, I could talk for a while. But
that is great. You know, I wrote an article in 1999 after the Columbine, and I put it up on my site today. It's called The Schooling. And one of the ideas that I put forward in there is that why don't we take our, just say the public schools, and start giving them gun safety classes in within those public schools, and then get the teachers familiar with how to handle weapons, and let's get principals and some of the key personnel and arm them. What do you think about something like that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I don't see any reason. For states that had right to carry laws prior to 95 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed, it was possible to go and carry permanent concealed handguns on school property. People often seem to think whatever the rules are right now, they're the way they've always been, and that's simply not the case. And yet there were no problems, not one single problem that I've been able to identify or anybody else has identified with all those states that allow teachers and others to carry permanent concealed handguns on school property. In fact, one of the things I mentioned earlier, the first of the public school shootings in Pearl, Mississippi, that was stopped by a permit holder, a guy named Joel Myrick, his former Marine, he used to carry a permanent concealed handgun with him when he taught there up until 95 when the Federal Safe School Zone Act was passed. At that time, being a good law-abiding citizen, he stopped carrying it on school property, parked it in his car more than a quarter of a mile off school property. When the attack started in October 1997, he had to run literally a half mile to get his gun, a half mile back, and was still able to hold the attacker at point-blank range on the ground for 11 minutes before the police arrived. But, I mean, that's an example of a teacher who used to carry his permanent concealed handgun on school property. And if he'd still been able to do it as a result of the law, if the federal law hadn't changed there, he probably would have been able to stop the attack much sooner than he actually did.
Right. What I'd like to see, instead of gun-free zones, gun-protected zones in the school.
Right, well.
See?
Well, I mean, I have no problem with that. I think adults, whether it be university level or any school, any place, the problem is, when you create these gun-free zones, those are the places these criminals attack.
Right. Well, I tell you, I just wish we could get, well, we need this media to start waking up to some of the information in your fine book here.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you letting me talk about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, John Lott, for being with us this evening. We certainly appreciate what you've done in this area. We certainly do.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Well, thank you very much. Good night. Okay, up there, James, thank you for running the engineering board. You did an excellent job. Thank you, Ted Anderson. And Tina, get well up there. We're getting ready to sign off, and we've got to do wake up about this gun rights thing. We need to maintain our gun and our gun rights and protect our children. And Ron Paul said that at one of his lectures up in Des Moines, Iowa. We need guns to protect our babies. Okay. Thank you very much for listening tonight.